Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Rabbi David Fine, who was instrumental in changing the anti-Semitic content in the most important passion play in the world at Oberammergau, Germany. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Mavena in Israel, Imbal Shtivi, and our Shinshinim, our young representatives of Israel, Shai Friedwald and Danielle Levy. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. It's very easy, with all of our attention focused on the coronavirus, to forget Passover is coming up fast. The great festival of freedom will be celebrated differently this year. As we remember the great liberation of our people from slavery in Egypt, this time we cannot truly fulfill the Mishnaic statement in the Haggadah, Kol dichvin yetzev yechul, let all who are hungry come and eat. At a time of social distancing and quarantine, having a huge Seder, the orderly ritual meal on the first and second nights of Pesach, is simply impossible. Which means many of us will be restricted to holding small family Seders, not a bad thing in and of itself, or participating in virtual Seders online, one of which I'll be leading myself. This may diminish the overall joy of a wonderful festival that's become the model for nearly every celebration of liberation from bondage around the world. But we shouldn't let Passover come without focusing on its eternal themes of struggling for freedom against oppression, of the joy of liberation, the rebirth of spring, and the need, always, to remember those who are not yet free. The Passover Seder is perhaps the greatest teaching device ever created for exploring the meaning of freedom. It incorporates elements that touch on every one of the senses to have us reflect on both the pain of enslavement and the joy of freedom. And it utilizes a variety of appeals to every part of our brains and bodies, making certain that we reflect on the miracle that liberation truly is. These ideas are encapsulated in certain elements of the Seder. There are, for example, four names of the holiday of Passover: Chag HaPesach, the holiday of the Passover offering, the lamb slaughtered on the original night of liberation some 3,250 years ago, whose blood on the doorposts indicated to God that the homes of the Israelites should be passed over by the angel of death. Chag HaMatzot, the festival of matzah, the unleavened bread of affliction we eat throughout the week of Passover, in memory of the haste with which our ancestors fled Egypt, not having time even to allow bread to rise. Chag HaAviv, the holiday of spring, season of rebirth and growth. And Zman Chirutenu, the time of our liberation, the great season of freedom from slavery and oppression. The Seder uses touch. We wash our hands twice during the evening. Taste, the bitter herbs of slavery, salt water flavor of tears, the sweet taste of charoset. Smell, the combination scent of matzah, manischewitz, and chicken soup with matzah balls is unmistakable. Sound, the many famous melodies of Passover, including Dayenu, perhaps the most famous Jewish ritual tune of all. And sight, the Passover Seder plate, the lifting up of each of the elements of Pesach, Matzah, and Maror, opening the door for Elijah the prophet. All of it is there to help us recognize just what freedom meant to our ancestors, and to compel us to see those in our world today who are not yet free. Which is a reminder that during a year of pandemic, when people everywhere are secluded from one another, when many find themselves in a kind of prison of quarantine or even active illness, that Pesach reminds us of the incalculable value of true freedom. It is so easy to take for granted our ability to live as we choose, to go where we want to go, to see anyone we wish, to buy what we want where we want without complications. The limits imposed on us now for the good of public health are small compared to the brutality of slavery. But even these can give us a taste of what it's like to lose our ability to live and flourish as we choose. There have even been some suggestions in this year of extensive personal hand-washing that instead of washing twice, we should wash after every one of the 16 steps of the Simon Leseder, the ordered progression of the ritual meal. Not a bad idea, actually, even if the Seder you're attending is small and everybody sits far from everyone else. Freedom is a universal value. And celebrating the festival of freedom at a time of fear, illness, and death can help us keep this all in true perspective and remind us that God will bring us to a time of freedom once again. May it happen speedily and soon. To play us in this morning, here's a wonderful rendition of Moshe Osher's Ki Lo Na'eh and Chad Gadya, songs from the Passover Seder, as performed by the three cantors, Abe Mizrahi, Dave Propus, and Meir Finkelstein, old friends from my days as a cantor. That was the three cantors singing Moshe Osher's wild Ki Lo Na'eh and Chad Gadya for Passover, which begins April 8th. When we return in a moment here on Two Jewish, our guest, Rabbi David Fine, will explain why passion plays remain so important culturally in Germany and the Western world, how their overt and subtle anti-Semitism has been an ongoing problem, and what he was able to do about it in Oberammergau, the most famous and important passion play in the world of all. Find out all about it when we return on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in the northwest of Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this spring. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson in the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha's synagogue is located at 2270 West Ida Road, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone in normal times. In these days of coronavirus tsoros, join us every Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat Live evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning Shabbat services are at 10 a.m. on Facebook, all with me leading them. Our Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, Beit Simcha Tucson. We will hold services with full music by virtual experience weekly for the time being. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are held on Zoom, which you can access if you don't already know how to find us on Zoom by emailing us at beitsimchatucson.org. We'll include you in our emails with the Zoom link. Our synagogue is at 2270 West Ina Road, west of La Cholla on the north side of Ina, at the entrance to the Foothills Mall, not in the mall, but in our own building. But for now, we are a fully functioning virtual congregation, Judaism by Zoom and Facebook Live. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services virtually, enroll in our Great Religious School and Torah Tikes program, also functioning virtually. Bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, all on Zoom. And, of course, our services on Facebook. Go to www.beitsimchatucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest Jewish community and fastest-growing synagogue in southern Arizona during its exciting beginning years.
We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Rabbi David Fine, who also has a Ph.D., has a remarkable, a deep experience of German and German literature, and was involved and continues to be involved in revising the famous Passion Play at Oberammergau, one of the, perhaps the most important Passion Play in the world. Tell us a little bit, David, about how you got involved in all of this.
I saw the Passion Play for the first time in 2010. It's held every 10 years, barring pandemic crises, and since the early 17th century. So I attended with a group in 2010 that was organized through the American Jewish Committee and an organization called Germany Close Up, and it provided an opportunity for me to get to know the director, the playwright who works on the screen, and was an engagement in how the Passion Play under its current leadership responds to elements of anti-Semitism that have plagued the play in the past, and how to confront that, how to tell the story of the trial, torturing and execution of Jesus without painting the Jews as the evil opponents. And that's something that's particularly critical in Germany, where the Passion Play takes place in Oberammergau, which is not far from Hitler's mountain lair, and he attended the Passion Play. He highly recommended it to all his senior advisors, and the Passion Plays of old painted the Jews as satanic figures. So the transition of that to how they do it now, with painting the Jesus as a rabbi, as with very Jewish identity, is almost a 180-degree turn from where, from how this story was told just a century ago.
Now, these Passion Plays have a deep history. They go back to the Middle Ages. and they are extremely popular. Just approximately how many people see this Oberammergau Passion Play when it is done?
Yeah, Oberammergau attracts about 500,000 visitors and when it shows, which is, again, is every 10 years. That's on productions between the middle of May through the beginning of October. It's about 80-some shows. The theater holds over 5,000 spectators.
So tremendously popular and a major sort of cultural part of not only the German scene, but really the European scene, the world scene, and yet deeply anti-Semitic in the past.
Yes, yes. The celebrity of the Oberammergau Passion Play has grown. There are many Passion Plays through the world. This is the most famous, and certainly famous in Germany, but people do attend from all over the world. It's not uncommon for example, evangelical tour companies start advertising Passion Play packages up to 2 years before the event.
We will talk much more about particularly the Oberammergau Passion Play and Rabbi David Fine's involvement in making it significantly less anti-Semitic, if probably the best way to put it, when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts, and completely virus-free.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
An index was released recently, the Freedom Index, which attempts to calculate how free every country on the planet is. And America had slipped a little. It's still considered a free country. I think it was an 84, 86% free or something. And Israel had dropped a little bit too, but it was still in the free countries around 76% at the very top of the index. I think Norway was at 100 or something, and various countries in various places. China was at less than 1%. When we think about freedom, this index seems to, it focuses on liberal democracies, representative democracies, places where everybody has a vote, where there's freedom of the press, where a variety of different metrics. That's one way of thinking about whether a country's, I don't know, a good country, I guess, but there are other measures. You know of some.
Right. Before we get to the other measures, the idea of freedom in some ways is subjective. But having spent a lot of my life, certainly over the past 50 years, in countries run by communist dictatorships or countries that were really police states, there is a different feeling in the air. Mm-hmm. People are cowed. And doesn't surprise me that China got less than 1% free, because I have this argument with all my friends and former students who live and work and teach in China. They find lots of redeeming qualities. I find it so oppressive. I mean, it's true. They managed to build a huge hospital in less than a week because basically they have unlimited slave labor because they can do whatever they want with their population. I was in one city a year or two ago in China where they were preparing for a summit, and they drafted tens of thousands of factory workers. They closed the factories because it's a police state. It's a centrally controlled economy.
Well, and then the factories run by some state organization.
Right. So they closed the factories and got these guys to plant flowers along the roadside and in the median strip on main highways that dignitaries were going to take on their way in from the airport. And they screened off areas that were like giant garbage pits or whatever. So visually, they completely transformed the way the city looked in 2 weeks. On the other hand, it's the only place I ever arrived where I went into a five-star hotel, and 5 minutes after I got there, reception brought up some local policewoman who wanted to interview me. she looked like a teenage girl wearing pajamas, but that's neither here nor there. It was a little intimidating to have this police woman in my room. Why am I here? Why did I come at this time? Why did I choose this hotel? The answer was that my hotel canceled my booking because of the bigwigs that were going to come, and they wanted to sweep the hotel and make sure there were no unacceptable people there. And this was like 2 weeks before the event. And each of the last three times I've been to China, there was some heavy manifestation of the fact that you were living in a police state where nobody had individual rights of any kind.
You know, it's funny, when I did High Holidays in Shanghai a couple years ago, I really enjoyed it. It was a great experience, fascinating community. And we were sending out emails with my weekly talks, and one of them I sent in, and the administrators, she always ran them by the president of the congregation. He said, "You need to change the title." And I said, "Why?" "Sure, I don't care, but why?" He said, "Well, I don't think our police censor would like it." And I thought, this is a different way to be.
Right, exactly.
And definitely it was a different way to be Jewish. Well, we'll come back to maybe some of those other measures of freedom, or, you know, whether a country's a good country or not, next week. Thanks so much, Tom.
I look forward to it.
We welcome to Two Jewish, our Shlicha on Israel, our Mivinar expert on Israel, Inbal Shtivi from the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Inbal.
Boker Tov.
Well, I wish it was Boker Or. I wish we could see the light at the end of the tunnel of this coronavirus crisis. Israel is following, in some ways, a parallel course to the United States, some ways a different one. Can you talk a little bit about how things are in Israel right now?
Yeah, sure. Yes, it's not such a bright morning, is it?
No,
it hasn't
sadly.
Been for a couple of weeks, yeah.
Right.
So Israel is in a way, a couple of steps before the United States in terms of its exposure to the virus itself. So the measures happening in taken in Israel would be more extreme, if I understand correctly. Just even only because the virus is already there for a couple of weeks. That means that Israel is now with counting of 2,660 people who contracted the virus, out of which 8 sadly passed away, and 68 are recovering.
So that's as the moment we're recording. Of course,
that's
those numbers change
moment.
All the time.
Numbers change and they grow in numbers. Every half day you can read. And all of a sudden it's 200 more or 100 more, and it changes all the time. But the efforts to flatten the curve, now that this is the term that everybody uses, are very much in place. Just yesterday or the day before, Israel entered a bigger lockdown policy. People are not supposed to go 100 meter, which is like 30 feet from the doorstep of their own house.
No, it's 300 feet. 300 meters. Yeah, about 300 feet.
Even when I'm 6 days, I won't know how to.
Yeah. Look, the meters, that's a conversion that takes years to get used to.
Yeah. So it's 300 feet from their doorstep.
Right.
People are not allowed to do anything unless it's, you know, vital something, go to the grocery store or anything else. So it's quite, and at the moment it's violating this rule entails even a financial consequence. This is one. Israel is now counting, because of the drop in tourism and other industries, so we're looking at a number of 500,000 unemployed.
500,000 unemployed in a country of about 8 million people, so getting to be huge.
Yeah, it is a big number. The government did do some things in terms of allowing those who have been taken out of the workforce, in a way, it's too complicated, but in a way to ease the entry point for, you know, some government subsidies for those who lost their jobs. It used to be a bit higher, the entry point. Now it's a bit lower.
Right.
But, of course, this virus has economic implications throughout the world, in Israel as well. I would say that in Israel, in a unique way, in a unique turn of events, in Israel it also, the entire virus situation goes just in parallel to the entire
rest of
political
the world.
Situation.
Oh, the political situation, okay.
The political situation where, with the virus going on, everybody in politics are trying to create the new government or not, or so.
So just complete uncertainty about so many things right now.
Complete uncertainty. My family and friends in Israel are very much uncertain at the moment. It's not
really challenging. We will maybe talk about the political. Yeah, no, I understand.
We always remember that we have been through so much.
Yeah.
All of us.
Yeah, of course.
And it's not. And by keeping home and we're keeping safe and health is the most important thing. All the other things can be corrected in the future. All of the other things.
Absolutely. Inbal, we'll talk about the politics next week, because maybe it'll be clearer by then. And just stay safe, keep your family safe and healthy. Okay.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. It's time now for our 2020 presidential election from a Jewish perspective. And then there were two, only no one was paying any attention. In the midst of the coronavirus crisis, the presidential race has come down to Joe Biden versus Donald Trump, as many expected a long time ago. It remains to be seen just how much in-person voting will actually be done going forward as states move to full lockdown mode due to COVID-19's insidious spread. That means not nearly as many people will actually be going to the polls, choosing instead to vote by absentee ballot or in some kind of online way set up by state governments. In fact, most Jews in America long ago switched to voting absentee, matching their demographic and socioeconomic peers. No hard data exists for this odd little statistic, even in our quant-dominated society, but the truth is that long before Election Day, may it come without social distancing restrictions speedily and soon, Jewish ballots will already have been cast. There's a reason for this that goes beyond convenience. When last I tried to take my kids with me when I went to vote in person, about, I don't know, 8 years ago, 6 years ago, I had to hunt for quite a long time even to find my new polling place. All the local ones had disappeared since everybody was already voting absentee in my area. In any case, it's not clear if coronavirus has had any impact so far on the Jewish vote, which always goes to the Democratic presidential candidate at between 67% and 80%, the remainder voting Republican, no matter how many absentee ballots are counted. And that was our 2020 presidential election from a Jewish perspective update. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie do, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. One day, Moshe goes up to his boss and asks timidly, "Mr. Gold, is it okay if I take tomorrow off? It's my golden wedding anniversary." "What?" replies Gold. "Is this what I have to put up with from you every 50 years? That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish. Just for you, you should live and be well. God willing, be well.
We welcome our Shin Shinim, Shai Friedwald and Daniel Levy, our young representatives of Israel. Boker Tov.
Achla Boker.
So we were talking off mic about films and movies that have come out. You know, the Israeli movie industry, which has been quite good for a long time, but very small, has really developed. There are Oscars for Israeli films, too, right? Let's talk about that a little bit.
It's called the Prize Ophir.
The Ophir Prize.
Yeah, and it's just the Israeli version of
the Oscars.
The Oscars. And compared to what it's like here, it's not as fun to watch. But
well, I don't think it's very fun to watch the Oscars anyway.
Well, it depends. Sometimes the dresses are pretty and, you know.
Yeah, the dresses are impressive. I see that. Okay. I'm not as interested in the dresses for some reason.
Yeah,
I apologize for that. The Israeli, you know, Israel's a small country, right? So in America, we think of movie stars as very distant. People follow them on Twitter or Instagram. I'm sure they do the same thing in Israel. But you could bump into a movie star in Ramat Gan or something, right? I mean, it's not such a far-fetched thing.
Right. So actually, I live close to Tel Aviv also. And there are a lot of, like, Los Angeles, Hollywood there. Yeah, yeah. So in Tel Aviv, there are a lot of coffee shops and restaurants that the famous people and actors and all the those people like to come, and then you can see them like riding their scoots. Like, you know who is Bar Rafaeli?
Bar Rafaeli, yeah. International.
So I see like her brother like once a week riding his scoot like, in Tel Aviv.
No, is that a scooter or is that a like a scooter. Electric scooter?
Electric scooter.
The electric scooter,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So without
the ones that almost always
also.
Kill you when you're walking around Tel Aviv because you can't hear them coming.
Yes.
Uh-huh. I know those. Okay.
And then like I bumped in one day like three celebrities. No, I'm kidding, but you know it's
no,
really
no, but it happens.
It's really common. Yeah, you know. Yeah, yeah.
See them riding their bike.
Yeah, yeah, yes. It's kind of a normal thing. People see that in New York City, and I when I was at UCLA, I used to run on the track there a million years ago, and like Dustin Hoffman would be running on the track.
Exactly. And, well, in Israel, it's not that big of a star.
No, maybe not. But
yeah, but
I don't know, Bar Rafaeli, you know, that's not, but that's
brother.
Just a brother, not
exactly.
Bar Rafaeli. Okay.
So
okay.
It's, yeah.
When movies come out in Israel, is it like a big scene that people, you know, rush to see the latest release?
No. I mean,
or is it only the latest American release that comes out?
Yeah, pretty much. Because you just expect more from American movies, I guess.
Well, certainly production values are a little fancier, but
exactly.
We expect more from Israeli TV shows than the movies.
And the Israeli TV shows have become so prominent, as we've talked about before, with shows like Vahuda and Shtisel, and even the bad shows are coming over now, like the Mossad show. So. Well,
exactly.
What is it they say? To see you at the movies. Toda rava,
Leitraud. Bye-bye.
And now a word of Torah. This week's portion is the second in the book of Leviticus Tzav, a section that establishes rules for the various sacrifices offered in the tabernacle in the wilderness, the Mishkan. These same sacrifices were also offered in the temple in Jerusalem for 1,000 years. There are many different types of sacrifices commanded in Tzav: burnt offerings, guilt offerings, sin offerings, and so on. But one group of sacrificial offerings stands out: the offerings of peace, the Zevach Shlamim. And among this higher category of offerings, one stands out the highest, the Zevach HaTodah, the thanksgiving offering. The rabbis thought so highly of thanksgiving to God, they are quoted in the Talmud saying, "When the Messiah comes, all sacrifices will have completed their mission. All will be discontinued with one exception, the thanksgiving offering. That sacrifice will last forever, even after the Messiah comes and the world is made theoretically perfect." Why are we to keep offering any sacrifices after the Messiah? Because, even in a perfect world, we must remember to give thanks, to be grateful for what we have. That's also true in the imperfect, pre-messianic, messy world in which we actually live. In fact, it might seem harder to be grateful when things aren't going well, and boy, right now, they are not. All of us experience challenges in life, but Tzav reminds us that it's essential we remember the many things we still have to be grateful for, and take the time to offer thanks for what we do have. This Shabbat is also Shabbat HaGadol, the great Sabbath preceding Passover. The name is taken from a famous Haftarah, which proclaims the coming of the great and awesome Day of God, in which the prophet Elijah will come and turn the hearts of children to their parents and the hearts of parents to their children. On the Shabbat of Tzav HaGadol, may we come to value those eternal blessings, health, family, friends, and the freedom to practice our faith in this special season of the year. May you be blessed with a really great, great Sabbath, and may your preparations for the upcoming Festival of Freedom go smoothly, no matter how restricted you feel right now, so that you have another reason to give thanks. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Rabbi David Fine, will tell us how he worked to remove anti-Semitic elements from the most famous Passion Play of all, the Oberammergau Passion Play, Hitler's favorite, and succeeded in changing it in subtle and meaningful ways. Find out all about it when we come back in a moment on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In Israel, as his blue and white party was on the verge of breaking up, the leader, Benny Gantz, was elected Speaker of the Israeli Knesset late last week. Gantz has been tasked by President Reuven Rivlin with forming a coalition government following elections earlier this month, Israel's third national vote in less than a year. The split in Gantz's blue-white party is over a debate about joining a unity government led at first by Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu. A unity government would provide Israel with a permanent government, something the nation hasn't had for a year, as it battles the current coronavirus crisis. It's not clear how stable any government will be. Talks on the unity government continue. The Israeli media reports that Gantz will hold the speaker's position for a short time until this unity government is formed. According to reports, Netanyahu would serve as the first prime minister, same guy, for 18 months. Gantz would be the foreign minister before taking over for Netanyahu in a year and a half. Gantz was elected speaker in a 74-18 vote. 28 lawmakers didn't show up for the Knesset balloting. The whole right-wing bloc voted for him. On Thursday of last week, Gantz declared himself candidate to become speaker in order to preserve the option of forming a unity government. He succeeds Yuli Edelstein, who stepped down a day earlier after shutting down the Knesset for several days over losing his post and pressing for a unity government. Critics said Edelstein was undermining Israel's democracy. The right-wing bloc agreed to support Gantz's speaker, a tacit acknowledgement of support for a unity government with the former military chief of staff, Gantz, while Avigdor Lieberman and his Yisrael Beitenu party, as well as the mostly Arab joint list, will join the new blue and white in the opposition, according to what we've heard. Yair Lapid and Moshe Ya'alon, the co-leaders of blue and white, filed a request in the Knesset to break from Gantz. Lapid and Ya'alon reportedly will continue to use the name blue and white. Gantz will go back and use the name of his own personal party, Resilience. Blue and white said initially it would support Mayor Cohen of Lapid's Yesh Atid party for speaker. Cohen was to use that position to drive a further wedge between Netanyahu and his Likud party by proposing legislation forbidding a lawmaker under indictment from forming a government and serving as prime minister. Netanyahu faces three corruption counts, but his trial has been delayed because of the COVID-19 outbreak. Gantz and Netanyahu further discussed a unity government in talks later in the week. Lapid told his Yesh Atid faction Gantz decided to crawl into Netanyahu's government. Reports say that in a unity government, a Likud member would serve as finance minister. Netanyahu agreed to give up the justice ministry, and Yechiel Trooper of Blue and White would take that position. In other news, Michael Rubin, partner in the NBA's Philadelphia 76ers and owner of Fanatics Sportswear, plans to make 1 million masks and gowns for emergency workers out of the same material normally used for Major League Baseball uniforms, which they don't need right now. Rubin said he was working with Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf, Attorney General Josh Shapiro, and MLB Commissioner Rob Manfred to repurpose a plant in Easton, Pennsylvania to make the gear. "We're fortunate to have this giant factory in Pennsylvania that makes all these baseball jerseys," says Rubin, who is, of course, Jewish, "and to have the commissioner of baseball behind us, the governor and attorney general saying, how do we make a difference?" Rubin founded his first business, a ski shop, when he was 14, using his bar mitzvah money as seed money. Ralph Lauren's foundation will dedicate $10 million to people affected by the coronavirus. The company he founded will continue to pay its own workers throughout the pandemic and will manufacture gowns and masks for medical workers instead of fancy clothing. The money will go towards employees affected by the virus and to the broader fashion community, to cancer patients vulnerable to the virus, and to the WHO's COVID-19 Solidarity Response Fund. Lauren, who was born Ralph Lipschitz, is the son of Jewish immigrant parents from Belarus. He stepped down as CEO of the company in 2015, but remains its chief creative officer. And Israel is sending a plane from El Al to Bogota, Colombia, to bring home 150 Israeli backpackers stranded in Colombia by coronavirus restrictions. It's part of a sweeping airlift effort to bring home Israelis who cannot get home from abroad. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews round the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish Art guests this morning, Rabbi David Fine, who has a PhD in German literature, is it?
Modern European History.
I'm sorry. I just I know that you have a deep knowledge of German and German history, has been involved through the American Jewish Committee in a significant effort, the key player in changing the Oberammergau Passion Play, which was scheduled to run this year in its every decade production. This is really an unbelievable undertaking. You described, I think, how elaborate the sets, the production, how many people are involved. Can you talk a little bit about sort of what this whole passion play means?
Sure. There are hundreds of people on the stage at a time. Animals on the stage, horses, camels, there's a full orchestra, a choir of hundreds of people. It's a major production, and everyone who participates has to be a resident of the town. The town of Oberammergau is a total population of only 5,500 people, so this is their thing. And the whole town revolves around the Passion Play. The Passion Play Theater is the largest building in the town, and the town's few hotels and restaurants and shops all serve as the lobby, in a sense, of the theater where the Passion Play is held. The play takes 6-7 hours to get through. There's the first act, maybe that's 2.5-3 hours, then there's a 2.5-hour break when everyone goes and finds the few restaurants in town to sit down. There's large, loud ringing of the bells when after 2 hours, when time to go back to the seats, everyone wanders back into the theater, and then they show the second act. Everyone's given the blankets there because it's a theater that's not quite winterized, and although it is in the summer, it's still in the Bavarian Alps, and you do get that refreshing mountain air there. It's quite an experience, and surrounded by beautiful scenery there, and it's something to see, and an opportunity only once every 10 years, which is why it attracts half a million people that go to it when it's showing.
So tell us a little bit about how you got involved. Obviously, you saw it. The American Jewish Committee is involved. These anti-Semitic elements have been there for a very long time. Can you describe some of them and how you approached dealing with them?
Some of the elements are driven by the text from the New Testament itself, where the leaders of the Sanhedrin work to arrest Jesus, to convict him, and push for his execution and press Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor, to execute Jesus. In the way this would be presented in the Passion Plays of old shows the Jews as very sinister, as calling vociferously for his execution. It's shown in the costumes where they'd be wearing pointy hats and dark or red robes. So it gives the sense of devilish figures who their sole purpose is to torture and have Jesus and have him executed. And the Romans are presented as sort of in the middle as Pontius Pilate washes his hands. He says, I put, and then there's the main line from Matthew where he says, this is on you and your descendants. And the Jews say, yes, it is on us. Crucify him, crucify him. So it's sort of a crescendo of the Jews calling for the death of Jesus. That is what we inherit from the text of the New Testament. But it's the way it's presented on stage with the costuming, with the sound, with the drama, emphasizes the intent, sort of the murderous intent of the Jewish crowd, the Jewish leaders and the crowd, to execute Jesus. This is something where there's been a shift in the latter half of the 20th century in finding ways to tell the story that shifts the blame away from the Jews. New Testament scholarship is focused on the fact that clearly the Romans were the ones who were the actors in the execution. The Jews were occupied by the Romans. They would not have had the authority on their own to call for an execution, which is why Pontius Pilate needs to do it. So through a critical reading of the text, it's argued by most scholars that the early founders of Christianity found it helpful to shift the blame away from the Romans in order to make it safer for Christianity to grow and to present their disagreement with the Jews of their time. What's been lost over the millennia in the common representation of the story through Passion Plays, for example, is that the disagreement between Jesus and his disciples and those Jews who opposed him was an internal Jewish disagreement rather than Jews wanting to murder Jesus. So that historical nuance is lost, and when it's told that way, it changes the contours, changes the sense of the story, and eliminates that anti-Semitic tone. The way they approached it and the changes that have occurred in Oberammergau that will be in the current production, that was certainly there also in the last one and started to make changes the one before, is to paint Jesus as very Jewish, as a rabbi, wearing a tallis, reading from the Torah, and to also, what we've been working on now in the counsel that we've been given, the Oberammergau team, is to also show the Jews, even those who's calling for the execution, as under pressure from the Romans, as not as conflicted, as not being evil sorts, and to represent the Roman authorities as the source of the true power here, which is not, you know, which is surely truer to the historical reality.
You worked so closely with Christian Stickel, I think that's the pronunciation. Tell me a little bit about how that evolved.
Christian is an extraordinary person. He's, as everyone involved with Oberammergau, he's a resident of the town. He's a professional theater person, and he has made it his mission at Oberammergau to reach out to his Jewish friends so that he can represent both with historical accuracy, but also to build those relationships and do everything he can to not only evolve, but to make up for the wrongs of the past.
Yeah, the deeply anti-Semitic and deeply anti-Semitic elements of the past at Oberammergau.
Yes. And the way that it was presented, like one of the most telling things he told me was that there's a part of when Jesus enters the temple and he has them open the Torah, and then the whole company sings a contemporary composition of the words of the Shema Yisrael, the Hero Israel. And he told me that he has everyone learn to pronounce it properly in Hebrew. Because he said, if the older people on the stage, he said, they were on the stage as children when Adolf Hitler sat in the audience. So now he makes them sing in Hebrew. You know, and there's a sense of righting the wrongs of the past that he's made it part of his mission, not just as an artist, but as what an artist ultimately is a teacher in transmitting a story to a new generation. And that's in truly inspirational.
In working on this, obviously Christian Stickel has a deep desire to kind of right the wrongs of the past. Did you experience any resistance? Did anybody express any resistance on the side of the German creators, producers of Avraham Mergel?
Yeah, he came into his position in the late 80s. So he did he first directed the 1990 production, but he was a young director then and had limited control over the elements of the production. The script has been handed down through the centuries and is considered canonical, almost like the text of the Gospels itself in Avraham Mergel.
It's like its own testament, as it were.
Exactly, right. Over time, as he's been successful and in running the play, he's been able to, as anything when you're in a position over years, he's consolidated his control and now has had more authority in being able to make changes than he did when he was a rookie director and is given a lot more leeway. The ultimate authority for Avraham Mergel is the town council. The town produces the play, but the town council decides who the director is of the play. And because he's been in that position for a long time and there's no competition now, because again, it's from a limited pool. There's only 5,500 people, including children and retirees who live in the town. He's the one who's a professional director. So it's clearly his show. He does have to work with other concerns in the town, but he has a freer hand as each production moves forward.
David, I know you were planning on leading what would have been an extraordinary tour to Avraham Mergel. I'm sure that's postponed because of all the coronavirus concern. I wonder, does anybody have any idea? Are they going to, I'm sure they're postponing the production. Would it be run a year later? Has that ever happened before at Avraham Mergel?
I was hoping that they would postpone it for a year later. They postponed it for 2 years. Made the decision last year. It's going to be premiere in May of 2022, which I understand is a cautious decision because they don't know when restrictions are going to lessen up. And in order to premiere in May is a whole year that moves up to it, and there's rehearsals, and it's a tremendous amount of preparation. And if we don't know at which point that things will loosen up. In order to hold rehearsals, he needs hundreds of people in the same place. So I think in order to play it safe, because it's a tremendous amount that's invested in the play, they decided to postpone to the summer of 2022. They did miss a production during World War II. I don't think there's been a missed production since then. So it will it'll be a two-year delay.
It will return. So remarkable work you've done. It should be fascinating to see, and people can go with you in 2022.
Yes, I hope so.
like everybody, we're planning very far in the future now.
Yes.
I want to thank Rabbi David Fine for a great visit here on Too Jewish. And you worked closely with the American Jewish Committee on this, as a member of it. Where do people go to find out more about the work of the American Jewish Committee?
If you go to their website, ajc.org, there's a section there, a tab on interreligious work. There's a whole page there on Avraham Mergel that has background articles and press releases there. So that would be where I would take a look.
Thank you so much, David.
Thank you.
All the
Good
best.
To talk to you. Thanks for having me.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with me this morning on Too Jewish. I'm Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be Ambassador and Rabbi David Saperstein, President of the World Union for Progressive Judaism. Our playout this morning comes from Avi Fryer, his special song for the coronavirus era. All my shiurim are on Zoom. All my classes are online. My friends, may you have a healthy week, God willing. A Shavua Tov, some good Pesach preparation, and a week, we pray, of peace.
I learned Parsha Shavua every Tuesday night. Till the virus from China locked my shul up tight. Everything's been canceled and it's got me feeling blue. Now my kids have been home since before Purim, but my gray cloud's lining as a silvery gleam, cause all my shiurim are on Zoom. No toilet paper at the store, no one's knocking on my door, I wear a mask and rubber gloves, still somebody finds...
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.